Welcome to Straight and Curly,
a podcast for self-improvement junkies.
I'm Kelly Exeter.
And I'm Carly Jacobs.
This is episode 81.
Hello and welcome to Straight and Curly. We're going to start this episode off with a listener review. This one comes from CSteen75, and this comment was made in April of 2017. I fell hard and fast for the Straight and Curly podcast. I too am an unashamed self-help junkie and think their take on the genre is both insightful and down to earth. It feels like sitting down with your girlfriends to have a chat. Plus, I could listen to their accents all day, and they're incredibly funny. If you're a fan of Gretchen Rubin, give them a shot. Can you hear Kelly's like glowing over there being compared to a Gretchen Rubin?
Oh, that's the best feeling ever. Thank you so much for that review. And thanks so much to everyone who's ever left us a review. The reason we're kind of mentioning them at the start of podcasts at the moment is because we recently changed over from being part of a network to not being part of a network. And in the process, we lost all our reviews.
It's so sad.
So devastating because we did spend nearly 2 years building those up. We had 85 reviews there. Gave us a 5-star rating on iTunes, and it's all gone. So if you have left us a review before and you're in a position to do another one again, we would love you forever. If you haven't left a review yet, we would love you too. And if you're not sure how to, please come into the Straight and Curly group on Facebook and we'll talk you through it. Reviews are really important. Reviews and subscribing to the show are really important as far as the gods of iTunes are concerned. So yeah, those two things help get us up the ladder or the list and get us in front of more people. So we would be, so grateful if you guys could take the time to do that. And today's episode is the final episode for this current season. We've had some really great conversations this season, Carls. I've really, really enjoyed it. And today, we're going to revisit old topic. So, do you want
to tell people? This is our final show for the current season, and today we thought it would be interesting to go back to the topic of food and diet. We did a 3-part series on that topic last year. They were episodes 28, 29, and 30, where we talked about various food myths and discussed our philosophies around healthy eating, including the contentious use of the phrase clean eating.
They were such interesting episodes and they were really, really well received by our listeners. I think people really appreciated the pragmatic and the non-dogmatic approach that we took, because there does tend to be such a cult mentality around most of the ways of eating at the moment. And I was the one who suggested we come back to this topic today because it's been well over a year since we did those 3 episodes. And I reckon we've both shifted our viewpoints on a few things since then. So this episode today isn't so much going to be a tip-based type thing like we normally do. It's going to be more of a general conversation between us about where we're at with our personal philosophies around what we do and don't eat. And I thought a good place to start would be with the word diet and our thoughts around diets in general. So, Carls, where do you stand on diets and dieting?
It's a little bit controversial, but I'm quite a fan of the concept of dieting. I see lots of talk online about people just, you know, eating whenever they're hungry and listening to their bodies and just eat the damn cake. And none of that has ever worked for me in my life ever. If I stop concentrating very hard daily on what I'm eating, I just gain like a kilo a week steadily until I stop doing that. So if I embraced these kind of holistic, mindful ways of eating that people are trying to advocate, I'd be at a very unhealthy weight very quickly without even trying. So I work super hard to look like the type of person who doesn't actually care much about what they eat. So that's my sad fate. I need to be on a diet or eating plan of some description in order to lose weight. And because I am a fluctuating human, I gain weight and then I lose it again. Because if I gain 2 kilos every year and I don't concentrate on losing it, I'll weigh an extra 20 kilos in a decade. And I think some people think I'm quite obsessed with my weight, and yeah, I actually am. So 2 kilos a year is nothing. I've gained 10 kilos in a year without even eating Tim Tams. So it's really, really important for me to stay on top of it. There's also a thing that I struggle with a lot is that there's a lot of talk about triggering eating disorders with talk about diets and clean eating, but the obesity epidemic is a very real problem, and we can't fall into the trap of treating it with kid gloves, at the expense of, you know, people who might be triggered into disordered eating. There was a Harvard Politics article that I found that I really quite liked, and I can link to it on Facebook, but there's a quote that I just wanted to share. This is actually based on America, and we're not as bad as America, are we?
I think we're pretty close.
We're close, but we're not close. Yeah. Quite there
we
yet.
Don't have the massive servings that Americans have, but and to be honest, we're actually going a little bit towards almost like California, in that we're coming a little bit more hyper, we're probably a little bit obsessive with, you know, paleo and gluten, yeah, and all of those things. But having said that, our obesity epidemic in Australia is as real as the obesity epidemic in the US.
Yeah, definitely. This is the quote: failing to deal with the reality of America's obesity problem for fear of perpetuating an unhealthy obsession with body image would be a disservice to the public and perilous for the health of the nation. However, it is equally detrimental to attempt to tackle obesity by promoting restrictive diets and extreme exercise regimens. Adopting approaches that focus on positive attitude and lifestyle changes not only protects against eating disorders and issues of body image, but also is actually more successful in preventing obesity. Therefore, America need not choose one fight over the other. The solutions to both are actually one in the same. I really enjoyed that quote, because I think by me pointing out that diets work for me, that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to work for everyone, and that there is a different approach for every person. And having said that, if you don't need to lose weight, never ever diet. Just eat a shitload of vegetables and keep doing you.
Yeah, there's two kind of things I want to pick up on in what you said. One was you kind of touched on the topic of moderation, because, you know, when you mentioned how people just like eat when you're hungry and, you know, listen to your body. And like, I've got a friend who's a dietitian, and, you know, people are like, what kind of eating method do you propose? And he's like, the eating method, I don't subscribe to paleo or to gluten-free or to any, you know, quitting sugar or any of these things. I subscribe to moderation. The problem with this, and it kind of drives me bananas, is that it's so easy for a dietitian to subscribe to the theory of moderation, because a dietitian is totally up with what they should and shouldn't be eating, and is totally educated on the topic and has a deep, deep understanding of the topic. So it's super easy for a dietitian to be moderate, even though what is moderation when we come to eating?
Exactly.
Your moderation, Carl's, is very different to my moderation, because we have completely different metabolisms and body types.
We both know I can't moderate. I abstain.
Yeah, and actually I'm the same as well. And then the other thing I want to touch on is this idea that talking about diets can perpetuate disordered eating and eating disorders. I have my own history with disordered eating, and I can say, okay, I can only speak for myself, but I can say with certainty that diets are not responsible for, we're not responsible for my disordered eating. Like, my own self-worth and self-esteem, we're responsible for disordered eating. So when people kind of point to, diets like I quit sugar, or ways of eating like I quit sugar and paleo, and say these are going to trigger off disordered eating, yeah, they probably will, but they're not the direct trigger. Like, the person who is participating in those and having maybe an orthorexia type approach to it, they would find a way to do that, irregardless of what diet they're on or what diets are out there at the time. Like, if you're a disordered eater, it's not the diet that's causing it. It's what's going on in your own brain. That's kind of my personal take on that. Where do I stand on diets and dieting? So I've got a health and fitness background, and so to me, the word diet has always simply meant like the food that you eat or the way that you eat. And I think the word diet has a lot of negative connotations because it usually indicates people associate it with restricted eating. But here's the thing, and here's the paradox. The reality is, if you are going to eat in a healthy manner, then by necessity, you are restricting yourself.
Yes.
Because nobody in the world can just eat whatever the hell they want without any kind of consequences. Like, this is just not reality. So I kind of, yeah, it's another thing that kind of does my head in when people are like, diets are so restrictive and, you know, this way of eating is so restrictive. I'm like, just eating in a healthy fashion is necessarily restrictive.
Absolutely.
Of course it is. Like, what do people want? And this is kind of another thing that gets me is that what people are aiming for is the ability to eat whatever they want, whenever they want. And that's just not realistic. And this is why we've gotten ourselves into the trouble that we're in, because we feel deprived when we eat well.
Yeah.
And that's a crying shame. We're so focused on what we can't eat instead of focusing on the great stuff that we can eat. So, yeah. So I do get a little bit annoyed when things like paleo or I quit sugar are referred to as diets in that negative way, when they're both simply ways of eating. And the main way of eating that they promote is a heavily plant-based diet where you just eat real food. So, it's a little bit of a bugbear of mine. With regard to dieting, I'm a little bit conflicted. I see if you use dieting or going on a diet as a way to kind of reset yourself when you've kind of slipped into some poor eating habits, I'm all for that, and I kind of use that method myself. What I'm not a big fan of is diets that heavily restrict calories as opposed to – so I don't have a problem with diets that restrict certain kinds of food or whatever, because as I said, all diets are necessarily restrictive, but – heavily restricting calories way, way below what the normal is for humans. So women need 1500 to 1800 roughly. Men need about 2200 and up, depending on their size. A lot of restrictive calorie diets are 1200 calories, and that's just not a lot of food, and it's not sustainable. And those
particularly
are
if you're exercising as well.
Yeah, so it's those diets where you can't – so here's the thing. So if you restrict yourself to a heavily – and I use restrict in, you know, air quotes. If you restrict yourself to a heavily plant-based diet where it's you're mainly eating vegetables every day, all day, you don't have to think about calories. Just stick to eating just real food and stick to eating veggies, and you will probably – lose weight. If you restrict your calories to 1200 calories, but you know, those 1200 calories is like a Mars bar and, you know, some kind of, I don't know, pavlova for dinner, which you can do because it's still dinner. Yeah, it's not sustainable. It's not teaching you good eating habits. That's the kind of thing that I don't like. So,
and you'll get scurvy as well.
Yeah. And those are the things that lead to this cycle of weight loss, weight gain, weight loss, weight gain. And they're the things that lead to kind of unhealthy mindsets around food. So I'm very pro diet. Yeah. I'm pro the diets that teach you how to eat well. I'm not pro the diets that teach you that you need to be starving all the time. That's the difference for me.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing with diets, like when I am on a diet, that is not actually that different to the way I eat every day normally. I eat extraordinarily healthily, but if I'm actually trying to lose weight, I will do things like cut out dairy. So like my maintenance mode is I eat yogurt, and then when I'm trying to lose weight, I will cut that out. There are things that I do that's different, that's in a different mode between maintenance mode and weight loss mode.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, at the heart of it all, we just need to become better educated about the stuff that we're putting into our bodies, basically. And I guess if we would try and address some of that today. So we're going to kind of talk about where we stand on a few contentious subjects at the moment. So, Carl, where do you stand on sugar?
Sugar. Honestly, I'm not a huge fan, but I also don't freak out about it. So at the beginning of the year, I was loosely following the ketogenic low-carb, high-fat diet. I wasn't seeing results. Ben saw great results, so good for him. That's great. I think he's lost about 10 kilos in the last year, the bastard. I wasn't gaining weight, but I wasn't losing weight either. So I've made some other changes, but as a happy accident, I have sort of given up sugar this year without even really trying. There has been a Magnum ice cream in my freezer since April and I haven't eaten it.
Oh my God.
Which is so weird because that's just unheard of. Ordinarily, if there was ice cream in my freezer, it would have been gone 20 seconds after it got brought into the house. And I adore ice cream a lot, but I just haven't really felt like it. Also, sugar has started tasting a little bit coppery to me and a little bit like blood, if that makes sense. So it's very unusual, but I just find sugar unnecessary in my day-to-day life. But if I'm going on a hike, I'll still have a muesli bar or a slice of dessert if someone made it for me. I'll have sugar in yogurt because I love yogurt. Even though I'm light on dairy these days, I love a full fat flat white and that's got quite a bit of sugar in it. So I eat sugar occasionally. I try not to seek it out. And if someone opens up a bag of Sour Patch Kids, I'm going to have one because they are my absolute kryptonite. But yeah, so it's sort of difficult when you say, oh, I don't really eat sugar. Because I don't, but then I don't want to, you know, be at a conference and have someone see me eat like a Mentos or something. And
I know.
So yeah. I'm very strict, but I'm also not binary. So when I say I don't eat sugar, I mean 95% of the time I don't eat sugar. And then maybe Ben and I will split a gluten-free caramel slice when we're away for the weekend. But when I say occasionally, I mean occasionally, not twice a week instead of 7 days a week. I mean like once every month.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So here's what irritates me. I'm going to be ranting a lot in this episode, so apologies in advance. What irritates me is hearing people, and it especially irritates me when I see dietitians writing articles on this, where they say they hate the whole I quit sugar movement because it's asking people to eliminate an entire food group. Sugar is not a food group. Sugar is found in certain foods. A lot of foods, actually, naturally occurring foods. This is the sugar I'm talking about. So second of all, so that's one thing that just gets me, calling sugar a food group. Second of all, so anyone who's actually done the I Quit Sugar program will tell you it's not actually about eliminating sugar. It is, and okay, I know that's what its name is called, but it's marketing, and unfortunately that's just how the marketing world works. But I Quit Sugar is not about eliminating all sugar from your diet. It's about reducing the amount of sugar in your diet down to the World Health Organization recommendations of around 6 teaspoons or 25 grams of sugar a day. And I know I sound like an ad for I Quit Sugar and I'm not anything to them. It's just something that I have done in the past and I have found it so useful for myself and it got me eating real food. So, the only way to reduce your sugar intake down to the WHO recommendations is by dropping processed foods from your diet and eating a diet that is based heavily around plants and eating food as close to the source as possible. And I guess the reason why I'm a big fan of it is because I grew up in the age of, it's not like my mum cooked from packets. When I became an adult, I hated cooking. So I went to packets because they were the fastest way to cook meals. So it was, it was the sugary sauces and the anything that was pre-made. The closest I could get a meal to pre-made, I would get it and I would eat it. And I had to, and that was not good for me. Like my allergies were completely out of control. My gut health was terrible. Like just there were so many the consequences for my body. And when I did I Quit Sugar, it just changed everything for me. And it taught me how to cook for myself. It taught me how to eat foods close to the source. It got me away from packaged and processed foods. And it kind of blows my mind how people will actively campaign against a diet that's teaching people how to cook for themselves and getting them away from processed foods. So Where do I stand on sugar specifically? I think it's a huge factor in the obesity epidemic plaguing the Western world. I also think it is negatively impacting gut health in the Western world quite massively. And more research is showing that poor gut health is linked not just to poor physiological health, but also really poor mental health as well. Like our guts are our second brains, and more research is showing this every single day. When you remove processed sugar from your diet and you reduce your intake to the WHO recommendations, you drop excess weight, your skin improves, your mental clarity improves, your behavior improves, both adults and children. So the benefits are manifest, and I kind of can't believe we're still having this conversation. But the good news is, like, you know, everything's reliant on popular media to get a conversation going, and it's now, like, you know, a given in popular media these days that, yeah, of course sugar's bad for us. But, you know, go back 15 years, or go back even, when did Sarah Wilson start talking about this, and when did who was the sweet poison guy?
Oh, I can't remember his name.
Oh my God, I'm thinking Gary Tobes, but it's not Gary Tobes. It's, oh my God, I can't believe I've forgotten his name. But anyway, the guy who wrote Sweet Poison and who influenced Sarah to start I Quit Sugar, like if you go back 7 years to 7 and 8 years to those guys doing that, like they were just outcasts for even suggesting it. And now it's just hilarious to me today to see in popular media how everyone's like, well, yeah, duh, of course sugar's bad for you. Like, yeah,
but also the whole problem with sugar is that it was used to put in low-fat products kind of from the 60s up to, you know, the 90s. That was back when people made up that fat was bad for you, which it's not, I can tell you, because I cook with full fat now and it's going very, very well for me. But you basically just replaced fat with sugar, and this was all just based on sugar companies wanting to get their product in more things and, you know, be able to sell these prepackaged items and chucking more sugar in them. And so it's all based on crap and all lies pretty much.
Yeah, it's so frustrating. So I'm going to ask you in a sec where you stand on wheat. But before we do, we're just going to have some quick words from our podcast sponsor.
If you're a regular listener of Straight and Curly, you'll know self-improvement is totally our bag. And what better way to self-improve than to go back to uni? With Open University's new offering, you can now study single module postgraduate units from leading Australian universities without having to enroll in an entire degree, which is awesome if you're a little bit commitment phobic and don't really know what you want to study.
Hey, that's right. Have you been thinking about upskilling in your current job, or maybe even changing career altogether? Because some of our listeners definitely have. And if you're wondering how the heck you'll find the time to do that, Open Universities provides you with the opportunity to learn the knowledge and skills that you need to make that change without the big time commitment.
Each unit is delivered by learning experts from some of Australia's leading universities, and you can study awesome subjects like cybersecurity, which sounds fascinating, actually. I was like, what do you even study in cybersecurity? Democracy and dictatorship, economics, marketing, mental health management, and online writing for those of you that are interested in writing careers.
So why not work in a way that is flexible for you? There are over 100 units to choose from. So head on over to open.edu.au and explore the courses they have on offer. Okay, so Carls, tell us, where are you on wheat?
Well, my partner is a celiac, so wheat doesn't really come into my house. The only place I have wheat, and it's actually gluten, is in oats. I like bread and I think it's a good food as long as it's grainy and brown, but it's not a daily part of my diet and hasn't been for over 15 years. If my body allowed it though, I'd have a fresh brown bread salad sandwich every single day with butter on it. Like that would just be my ideal lunch. But it doesn't agree with me. It's not a food that I function well on. It's also been disproven that you can have a gluten intolerance. So there's scientific research that shows you can be allergic to gluten, but you can't have an intolerance. But in my test group of one, I call total bullshit on that, because sometimes I'll go to a mate's house and they'll have garlic bread and I'll eat it because I'm human and garlic bread's amazing. And I eat garlic bread once every 5 years,
yeah.
But it does terrible things to my gut. And it, like, like I, it only does that because I haven't had it in ages. If I had have had garlic bread 10 years ago, it wouldn't have made a difference. But because I have kind of weaned myself, not on purpose, just because, you know, I eat as a family with my partner and he can't eat wheat, so therefore I don't eat wheat. It just, I've given myself a weird little intolerance to it. It's not, I'm not going to demonize gluten. I don't find it necessary in my diet, and I know lots of people that have had really good results from giving up gluten. But if you don't feel like you need to and it doesn't make any difference to your life, keep eating your beautiful sourdough spelt bread with, you know, a big salad on the side. That's totally fine.
Yeah, I'm a little bit the same as you guys. So, well, neither Ant nor I eat wheat anymore, but for different reasons. So me, it's because I just find my gut works better when I don't eat wheat. So I'm kind of not too phased about gluten. I don't go completely gluten-free, although I do ask for gluten-free things at when I'm at a meal. But it's just I generally just avoid wheat. So I don't eat bread and I don't eat pasta and, you know, I don't eat things coated in breadcrumbs. And what I find, yeah, other than my gut working better, is I also have better brain clarity. The reason Ant doesn't eat wheat is because he had these permanently aching joints for years, and I had seen some research that showed that removing gluten from your diet, that gluten can inflame joints and give you achy joints. So I suggested to him to give it a go of coming off it. And this thing that he had for literally years and years, he just thought it was normal and part of life, suddenly disappeared when he stopped eating wheat. So easy for him to do. He just stays off it now because otherwise his joints hurt. All that said, like, I'm not totally anal about it. So if I look at a freshly baked loaf of sourdough and I really, really want a piece of it with some butter lashed across it, I'm just going to have it. If someone bakes me a cake for my birthday, I'm going to eat it. So I employ the 80-20 rule when it comes to wheat. And our kids eat bread and they still eat pasta. And I'm kind of keen to get to the point that my kids kill me because they will only eat store-bought white bread.
Oh, like, gross.
I kind of vomit every time they eat it, and I make them sandwiches using it. So my goal is to learn how to make a really genuine, proper sourdough, and that if they're going to be eating bread, like, that can be the bread that they're eating, because what it is, the sourdough is fermented, and that does something to the gluten. It doesn't eliminate it, but it breaks it down and makes it easier for the body to process.
Yeah.
So I haven't seen any firm research on this, but there's a lot of anecdotal stuff that says, okay, look, if you're going to eat bread, make it a genuine sourdough, not like the mass-produced sourdough that you buy from the shops, like one that you literally make in your own home. But generally speaking, with wheat, I'm with you. I just think just experiment on yourself. If you find coming off, it makes absolutely no difference to how your body operates, how your brain operates, how your gut operates. God bless you. How lucky are you? Go for it. Just eat as much wheat as you like.
Just in the interest of sharing, I'm not a huge fan of pasta. Like, I could happily not eat pasta ever again. There's a whole bunch of things that are involved with wheat that I give zero shits about, but I will crawl over my dead mother for a dumpling. I love dumplings so hard, and I don't care what I'm doing, what kind of diet, anything. I don't care. If we're going out for dumplings, I'm participating fully in that situation.
and who cares about the consequences?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I'm a bit like that with dairy. We're not specifically talking about dairy in this show, but I had to come off dairy years ago because it triggered sinus allergies in me. And I really, really miss dairy, and it took me a really, really long time to get off it for that reason. Like, it's just everything I liked was related to dairy. So,
see, I'm currently not doing dairy at the moment, just because I get really intense period pain, and I had a few people suggest that cutting back on dairy will help with that, and it straight up did. It's a really hard thing to self-police, because I'll look at this delicious, beautiful coconut yogurt, and I love dairy. I'm a dairy whore. And I'll just go, I just want to eat this beautiful yogurt. And then it's like, but do you want to be in pain in 3 weeks' time? It's such a weird trade-off, because you're kind of going, but but I might not be.
And it's such a future thing as well, isn't it?
So future. And I'll be like, but now Carly just really wants to eat this yogurt. But I've been very good, and it's been making a very big difference. So let's move on to meat now. So here's where I stand on meat. I used to buy organic meat and very sparingly, but I watched a great doco on SBS by Michael Mosley called The Truth About Meat, and it opened my eyes up to some really interesting stuff. For example, there's a lot of research that shows factory farming is actually better for the environment than free-range and organic meat farming, and many organic free-range practices are based on what they call human vanity metrics. So we think that cows are happier in green fields and being fed grass when there's no real evidence to show this is true. So a lot of these happy animal practices came into place because people were seeing grain-fed cows in brown fields and thought, oh no, they look really sad. But there wasn't really any evidence to suggest that they were. I mean, I'm obviously not advocating cruelty to animals in any way, but I do believe I'm higher on the food chain, and that is how the circle of life works. I've also got a weird iron thing where my body doesn't store excess iron. So if most people can have like one piece of red meat a week and your body will just use all the excess iron, I don't store the excess. So I only use what my body can use, and then the rest gets thrown away. So I have to top up my stores a bit more than other people. Having said that, you should only eat between 300 to 500 grams of red meat per week anyway, which is three very small or two largish serves. And most people eat heaps more than that anyway. So my stance on meat is to eat meat sparingly. But also regularly, because you need to have meat as well. But I also eat a lot of fish as well. That's a big thing. And I mean, none of what I said is hard and fast and straight up true, but I've got links here on meat-based diets and also The Truth About Meat, the Michael Mosley documentary. And he's very, very smart. He does lots of gut health and bacteria stuff. And he's the guy that invented the 5-2 fasting diet. And he also has a great show called Trust Me, I'm a Doctor, where they do really excellent experiments on people. So I realize I haven't really made a stand on meat, but I have lots of information and ideas swirling around. And that equals small quality portions of meat once or twice a week.
Yeah, it's really hard to find peer-reviewed research on this because that you can, whatever your stance on meat is, you can find research in rabbit ears that supports your stance. It's a really, really difficult topic to research accurately. So my stance on meat is I like it, and I'm not philosophically opposed to eating it, but I am opposed to the idea of the animals I'm eating having a terrible life while they are alive. So,
absolutely.
My friend Alex Stewart says, ideally, the worst day of the animal's life should be the day they die to become your food. So I'm trying to become better educated on that element of this topic, and I'm trying to ensure that the meat my family eats is sourced from places where animals are treated well while they are alive. So I'm going to take a look at that documentary, that Michael Mosley one that you've mentioned, Carl.
That one is UK based, and I don't base everything on that documentary, but it did give me some really good ideas and things to question, because I was just mindlessly buying organic meat thinking that that was the best thing to do when the emissions are so much higher through organic farming than they are through factory farming. And then you've got the dilemma of, well, do I care about the animals or do I care about the environment? And that is a really huge question.
Rightio. I avoid a lot of these shows about how animals are treated, I have to be honest, because I think if I watched them, I would just wouldn't want to eat meat. But I know a lot of the shows are not reflective of what happens in Australia or Australian practices. So it's very difficult to be truly across all these things. And if anybody does have any kind of really genuinely good, well-researched, trustworthy stuff that they can point us to, that would be awesome. On the topic of whether we actually need to eat meat or not, Look, at some stage, Homo sapiens gained control of fire and thus the ability to cook meat. So there's a lot of debate around whether we are genuinely omnivores or whether we're herbivores who have learned to be omnivores purely because we can cook meat now and the cooking of the meat means our teeth can handle it. It doesn't matter whether we are genuinely designed to be herbivores or omnivores. The fact is we can eat meat, and the ability to eat meat and access the calories and nutrients and fats available in that meat allowed our species to survive in times and climates where there just weren't a lot of plants around, to be honest. So it allowed us to survive in cold climates, allowed us to survive through droughts. So, and as Carly kind of intimated, mentioning meat-based Neanderthal diets are kind of why we're smart today. Our ability to create fire and thus cook meat allowed our guts to get smaller, which allowed our brains to get bigger.
It's quite ironic because the reason why we are smart enough and have the consciousness to question whether or not we should eat meat, the reason why we have the ability to do that is because we ate meat.
Because we ate meat. And this is a thing, and it's kind of like a large part of the debate is, do we need to eat meat today in modern times? And the answer to that is probably not, because we do have the ability to access most of the necessary nutrients from other forms of food. However, like, there are a lot of people like you, Carly, and I am like this to a certain degree, and certainly I mentioned Alex, she's the same. Like, we struggle to maintain our iron levels when we stop eating meat. So yes, you can get iron from supplements and from eating lots of spinach, but it's not as bioavailable as eating meat and getting iron that way. So
spinach isn't as high in iron as everyone thinks it is.
Yeah, exactly. And you would have to eat like bags and bags of spinach to get the same amount of iron as like just a small piece of steak would, a palm-sized piece of steak would give you. So it's not really practical. So it kind of like, as with most things we've mentioned today, it kind of comes down to you and your philosophical leanings and your personal preferences and beliefs, and just an understanding of what works for your body and what doesn't. And I think that's kind of the thing, the approach that ties us together, Carls, is we've both researched and we've experimented on our own bodies and we've figured out what works for our bodies, and that's the way we follow. And we try not to be too dogmatic about it. Did you agree?
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely.
Cool. We're going to kind of finish up this episode like just by sharing what a typical eating day looks like for each of us, because this is something we do get asked quite a bit. So here's the episode to do it. So, Carls, what does your typical eating day look like?
So at the moment I'm being extremely strict and I've started fasting from 8 p.m. at night until midday the next day, and it's been working absolute wonders for me. So I tried the 5-2 a few years ago and it was very effective, and my body responds quite well to having those fasting days, because I have a really, really slow metabolism, and if there is any food at all in my body will just like really slowly squirrel it away and burn it, and that's just not effective for weight loss at all. So,
or even weight maintenance.
Yeah, or weight maintenance, exactly. Yeah, so I've lost 7 kilos now this year, which is good.
Yeah.
I lost 4 the last time we spoke, and I had that big meltdown about how I wasn't losing weight. and I only have to lose 4 centimeters off my waist for it to be in the healthy zone, so that's really good. So I've lost 13 centimeters off my waist this year, which has been really good.
That is amazing. That's amazing. I'm so glad that the number on the scales is shifting now to reflect that, because it wasn't shifting before. And I couldn't understand it.
And it's so motivating. And it's not like I've actually made massive changes. I've just tweaked little bits and pieces, because as I said, I eat very healthily all of the time and have done for 15 years, and I exercise 5 times a week. So it's been a very frustrating experience for me. So I'm now only about 10 kilos over what I want to be. And that's really hard to lose, because the closer you are to your optimal weight, the harder it is to lose it.
Yeah.
So if you, are 50 kilos overweight, losing the first 30, I'm not going to say it's going to be easy, but it will be a lot easier than losing the last 20. So at the moment I don't eat until midday. So then I will have a spinach mushroom and goat's cheese omelette. And then at 4 p.m. I'll have a big salad. So it'll be a salmon salad with avocado and spinach and some whole egg mayo. I make sure I've got lots of vegetables and good fats in every meal that I have. And then for dinner, I'll have fish or meat with roasted broccoli and cauliflower. I try, again, because I'm being very strict at the moment, I try not to snack in between. But if I'm particularly hungry, I'll have some nuts or peanut butter celery sticks or a green smoothie. And a few times a week, I'll have an unsweetened coconut milk sugar-free hot chocolate because I'm crazy like that. And yeah, I do really want to reiterate that I am being extremely strict at the moment. And before I started fasting, I'd always have breakfast, but I'm coping very well without it. And also one night a week, I'll have 3 glasses of wine. And I enjoy that and I won't stop doing that. And when I'm not in a weight loss phase, I'll start having wine more nights. I very rarely drink during the week, but Friday and Saturday nights, I'll have a couple of glasses of wine. So I've got 4 more weeks to go on the challenge that I'm doing. And when it's relaxed, I'll have some dinners out and that kind of thing and go back into my maintenance mode.
Yeah, cool. So I'm like Carly, I have a body that so long as I'm eating reasonably healthily and exercising regularly, I will maintain a healthy weight and my weight doesn't fluctuate too much. So my typical eating day, which is quite different to my typical eating day when I was doing triathlons, God, that back then I was just eating anything and everything and ironically struggling to lose the weight that I needed to get down to race weight because I was literally eating so much. So it goes to show you, even though I was training 25 hours a week. So it goes to show you can't out-exercise bad nutrition. So my typical eating day today is I have a green smoothie for breakfast. And that's, I just love that because it takes all the decision-making out of breakfast for me. Then I'll have some nuts and or a piece of fruit around morning tea. Lunch will usually be leftovers of whatever dinner was the night before, or I like doing frozen veggies fried up in a pan with some eggs. In the early afternoon, I'll have some more nuts and or fruit as a snack. And then for dinner, which I tend to eat dinner around 6 o'clock.
Oh my God, that's such a pensioner time to eat dinner.
I've just always eaten dinner really early. I don't know why. I think because I'm just
because you go to bed at like 8 o'clock. Oh, wait.
Yeah, well, that's probably why. So I eat dinner around 6 o'clock, and it's usually something like roast veggies with roast meat, chicken or fish, or rice and a meat dish like curry or mash with some bolognese. And I do try to eat over the course of day. I try to eat a good amount of vegetables, so I get a good amount of vegetables in my green smoothie. And then I get some more in my lunch because it's usually the leftovers of the night before. And then I always have, there's always veggies at dinner or salad at dinner. And I don't usually eat dessert because we just don't have dessert in our house. If you don't have it in the house, you can't eat it. And after I've eaten dinner, I just don't generally have anything else to eat for the night. So I go to bed at 8:30. So this is how I can get away with that. If you're staying up till 11 o'clock, you're going to get hungry. But I go to bed at 8:30 so I can wake up at 4:15 to write. So what I find is most days I end up having a 12 to 13 hour fast between dinner and breakfast. And yeah, I find that makes it very easy for me to maintain a healthy weight. So
and I think the fasting thing has just been massive for me because the 5-2 was really effective, but the full days of fasting really killed me. But stopping eating after dinner and having some herbal tea and then going to bed, because that's what normal people should do. You shouldn't eat after dinner.
Nighttime
snacking is not ideal for anyone.
It's a habit. It's not a need. It's a habit.
And you're not doing anything. You're just sitting around. It's not like you need extra energy. It's just because you want to. And I've always been a snacker. Like if there's food around, I'll eat it. And then so not eating after dinner is just normal. And then I wake up in the morning and I go to the gym. And then by the time I get home from the gym, it's 9 o'clock and I start my work day. I work for 3 hours and then I break for lunch. So I'm basically only fasting for 3 hours.
Yeah. Because that's awesome.
Only what it feels like.
Yeah. And I just think, like, I mean, the general approach, because I don't have to be super, super strict about what I eat. And like, okay, so I might put on 1 or 2 kilos if I go on holiday and I just don't think much about what I'm eating. But then what I find is when I come home, I revert to my normal eating habits and my normal exercise habits, and those kilos drop back off. So I take a very 80-20 approach to eating, in that when I'm at home and I'm in control of what I'm eating, I eat well, so that if I go away to a conference, like I just had to go on successive weekends away to a conference, and I was like joking with you a few episodes away ago that I ate more sugar on one of those weekends than I'd eaten all year. And that was probably true, but I can do that because I eat well 80% of the time. So the 20% of the time that I just kind of go, you know what, who cares? I'm going to have this giant brownie. It doesn't really matter because I'm not doing that every single day. So that's my approach to eating, is a very 80-20 thing, and also very much when I'm in control of my eating, I eat well, so that when I'm not in control of what I'm eating because I've gone to someone's house or I'm at somewhere where I'm being served up a certain meal, I don't have to be obsessive about, oh, I shouldn't be eating this. Like, it doesn't matter. I just eat it and then readjust when I get home.
Yeah.
So closing thoughts to finish up this episode. These are my thoughts. So I personally think, look, if people are trying to improve their diets and make positive changes without getting all caught up in, you know, paleo this and sugar that and, you know, low carb, high protein this, probably the most impactful thing you can do is to move your diet away from processed foods towards food you make yourself, because this allows you to take control of just how much added sugar and preservatives and, you know, foods that are numbers, which means they're not foods that you are eating. So that in itself is a really big, good health move. And then the other thing that both Carly and I do love doing is we love focusing on eating more veggies. So we've done a whole episode on this. If you look up Straight and Curly 5 cups of veggies on Google, you'll find it. So if you try to eat 3 to 5 cups of veggies a day, like, this is going to crowd out your plate with things that are high in nutritional value, and it leaves less room for things low in nutritional value. So, and I guess the other thing is we try not to label foods as bad or good, although we did have an interesting conversation about this in episode 29.
Objectively, some foods are bad, Kelly. They just are.
No one can say a Mars bar is good. No. But yeah, I think, but you know, but there's a lot of people are like, oh, if you label foods good and bad, then people attach like certain feelings to them and shame and all that stuff. And it's like, okay, well then let's just call foods high in nutrition and low in nutrition, and nobody can argue against that.
Because it's factual.
Because it's fact. Yep. Hey guys, just a quick last minute message from us. As we mentioned at the top of the show, this is our last episode for a few weeks. And if that makes you sad and you're thinking, where can I get a bit more Straight and Curly while I wait for new shows? Carly and I have a treat for you. So we have turned all our episodes on detoxes and diets into a book, and it's available now from our website. So if you head to straightandcurly.com/books, you can find out more. See you in a few weeks.
Thank you so much for listening to Straight and Curly. This week's show notes and links will be available at straightandcurly.com.
And if you have any questions or weird self-improvement hacks you want us to trial, you can tweet us at Kelly Exeter or at Smaggle, or you can email us at hello@straightandcurly.com.